Mortifying. There's another way, Piper said. You don't have to kill us.
Jason clawed his way to the surface again. A miniature storm cloud formed over his head. Thunder boomed.
None of that, son of Jupiter, Echolois chided. If you call lightning, you'll just electrocute your girlfriend.
The water pulled Jason under again.
Let him go!
Piper charged her voice with all the persuasiveness she could muster.
I promise I won't let Hercules get the horn.
Echolois hesitated. He cantered over to her, his head tilting to the left.
I believe you mean that.
I do, Piper promised. Hercules is despicable, but please first let my friend go.
The water churned where Jason had gone under. Piper wanted to scream. How much longer could he hold his breath? Echolois looked down at her through his bifocals. His expression softened.
I see. You would be my Deianira. You would be my bride to compensate for my loss.
What?
Piper wasn't sure if she'd heard him right. The whirlpool was literally making her head spin.
Actually, I was thinking...
Oh, I understand, Echolois said. You were too modest to suggest this in front of your boyfriend. You are right, of course. I would treat you much better than a son of Zeus would. I could make things right after all these centuries. I could not save Deianira, but I could save you.
Had it been 30 seconds now? A minute? Jason couldn't hold out much longer.
You would have to let your friends die,
Echolois continued.
Hercules would be angry, but I can protect you from him. We could be quite happy together. Let's start by letting that Jason fellow drown, eh?
Piper could barely hold it together, but she had to concentrate. She masked her fear and her anger. She was a child of Aphrodite. She had to use the tools she was given. She smiled as sweetly as she could and raised her arms.
Lift me up, please.
Echolois' face brightened. He grabbed Piper's hands and pulled her out of the whirlpool. She'd never ridden a bull before, but she'd practiced bareback Pegasus riding at Camp Half-Blood, and she remembered what to do. She used her momentum, swinging one leg over Echolois' back. Then she locked her ankles around his neck, wrapped one arm around his throat, and drew her knife with the other. She pressed the blade under the river god's chin.
Let Jason go.
She put all her force into the command. Now! Piper realized there were many flaws in her plan. The river god might simply dissolve into water. Or he could pull her under and wait for her to drown. But apparently her charm speak worked. Or maybe Echolois was just too surprised to think straight. He probably wasn't used to pretty girls threatening to cut his throat. Jason shot out of the water like a human cannonball. He broke through the branches of an olive tree and tumbled onto the grass. That couldn't have felt good. But he struggled to his feet, gasping and coughing. He raised his sword, and the dark clouds thickened over the river. Piper shot him a warning look. Not yet. She still had to get out of this river without drowning or getting electrocuted. Echolois arched his back as if contemplating a trick. Piper pressed the knife harder against his throat.
Be a good bull, she warned.
You promised,
Echolois said through gritted teeth.
You promised Hercules wouldn't get my horn.
And he won't, Piper said. But I will.
She raised her knife and slashed off the god's horn. The celestial bronze cut through the base like it was wet clay. Echolois bellowed in rage. Before he could recover, Piper stood up on his back. With the horn in one hand and her dagger in the other, she leaped for the shore.
Jason!
She yelled. Thank the gods he understood. A gust of wind caught her and carried her safely over the bank. Piper hit the ground rolling as the hairs on her neck stood up. A metallic smell filled the air. She turned toward the river in time to be blinded.
Boom!
Lightning stirred the water into a boiling cauldron, steaming and hissing with electricity. Piper blinked the yellow spots out of her eyes as the god Echolois wailed and dissolved beneath the surface. His horrified expression seemed to be asking, "How could you?"
"Jason, run!"
She was still dizzy and sick with fear, but she and Jason crashed through the woods. As she climbed the hill, clasping the bull's horn to her chest, Piper realized she was sobbing, though she wasn't sure if it was from fear or relief or shame for what she'd done to the old river god. They didn't slow down until they reached the crest of the hill. Piper felt silly, but she kept breaking down and crying as she told Jason what had happened while he was struggling underwater.
"Piper, you had no choice."
He put his hand on her shoulder.
"You saved my life."
She wiped her eyes and tried to control herself. The sun was nearing the horizon. They had to get back to Hercules quickly, or their friends would die.
"Achilles forced your hand," Jason continued.
"Besides, I doubt that lightning bolt killed him. He's an ancient god. You'd have to destroy his river to destroy him. And he can live without a horn. If you had to lie about not giving it to Hercules, well, I wasn't lying."
Jason stared at her.
"Pipes, we don't have a choice. Hercules will kill..."
"Hercules doesn't deserve this."
Piper wasn't sure where this rage was coming from, but she had never felt more certain of anything in her life. Hercules was a bitter, selfish jerk. He'd hurt too many people, and he wanted to keep on hurting them. Maybe he'd had some bad breaks. Maybe the gods had kicked him around, but that didn't excuse it. A hero couldn't control the gods, but he should be able to control himself. Jason would never be like that. He would never blame others for his problems or make a grudge more important than doing the right thing. Piper was not going to repeat Deianira's story. She wasn't going to go along with what Hercules wanted just because he was handsome and strong and scary. He couldn't get his way this time. Not after threatening their lives and sending them to make Achilles miserable for the sake of spiting Hera. Hercules didn't deserve a horn of plenty. Piper was going to put him in his place.
"I have a plan," she said.
She told Jason what to do. She didn't even realize she was using charm speak until his eyes glazed over.
"Whatever you say," he promised.
Then he blinked a few times.
"We're going to die, but I'm in."
Hercules was waiting right where they'd left him. He was staring at the Argo II, docked between the pillars as the sun set behind it. The ship looked okay, but Piper's plan had started to feel insane to her. Too late to reconsider. She'd already sent an iris message to Leo. Jason was prepared, and, seeing Hercules again, she felt more certain than ever she couldn't give him what he wanted. Hercules didn't exactly brighten when he saw Piper carrying the bull's horn, but his scowl lines lessened.
"Good,"
he said. "You got it.
In that case, you are free to go."
Piper glanced at Jason.
"You heard him. He gave us permission."
She turned back to the god.
"That means our ship will be able to pass into the Mediterranean?"
"Yes, yes." Hercules snapped his fingers. "Now the horn."
"No,"
Piper said. The god frowned.
"Excuse me?"
She raised the cornucopia. Since she'd cut it from Achilles' head, the horn had hollowed out, becoming smooth and dark on the inside. It didn't appear magical, but Piper was counting on its power.
"Achilles was right," she said. "You're his curse as much as he is yours. You're a sorry excuse for a hero."
Hercules stared at her as if she was speaking in Japanese.
"You realize I could kill you with a flick of my finger," he said. "I could throw my club at your ship and cut straight through its hull. I could..."
"You could shut up," Jason said. He drew his sword. "Maybe Zeus is different from Jupiter, because I wouldn't put up with any brother who acts like you." The veins on Hercules' neck turned as purple as his robes.
"You would not be the first demigod I've killed."
"Jason is better than you," Piper said. "But don't worry, we're not going to fight you. We're going to leave this island with the horn. You don't deserve it as a prize. I'm going to keep it to remind me of what not to be like as a demigod, and to remind me of poor Achilles and Deianira." The god's nostrils flared. Do not mention that name. You can't seriously think I'm worried about your puny boyfriend. No one is stronger than me.
I didn't say stronger, Piper corrected. I said he's better.
Piper pointed the mouth of the horn at Hercules. She let go of the resentment and doubt and anger she'd been harboring since Camp Jupiter. She concentrated on all the good things she'd shared with Jason Grace, soaring upward in the Grand Canyon, walking on the beach at Camp Half-Blood, holding hands at the sing-along and watching the stars, sitting by the strawberry fields together on lazy afternoons and listening to the satyrs play their pipes. She thought about a future when the giants had been defeated, Gia was asleep, and they would live happily together. No jealousy, no monsters left to battle. She filled her heart with those thoughts, and she felt the cornucopia grow warm. The horn blasted forth a flood of food as powerful as Achilloas's river, a torrent of fresh fruit, baked goods, and smoked hams completely buried Hercules. Piper didn't understand how all that stuff could fit through the entrance of the horn, but she thought the hams were especially appropriate. When it had spewed out enough goodies to fill a house, the horn shut itself off. Piper heard Hercules shrieking and struggling somewhere underneath. Apparently even the strongest god in the world could be caught off guard when buried under fresh produce.
Go, she told Jason, who'd forgotten his part of the plan and was staring in amazement at the fruit pile. Go!
He grabbed Piper's waist and summoned the wind. They shot away from the island so quickly, Piper almost got whiplash, but it wasn't a second too soon. As the island retreated from view, Hercules's head broke above the mound of goodies. Half a coconut was stuck on his noggin like a war helmet.
Kill!
He bellowed, like he'd had a lot of practice saying it. Jason touched down on the deck of the Argo II. Thankfully, Leo had done his part. The ship's oars were already in aerial mode. The anchor was up. Jason summoned a gale so strong, it pushed them into the sky, while Percy sent a 10-foot-tall wave against the shore, knocking Hercules down a second time in a cascade of seawater and pineapples. By the time the god regained his feet and started lobbing coconuts at them from far below, the Argo II was already sailing through the clouds above the Mediterranean. Chapter 29. Percy. Percy was not feeling the love. Bad enough he'd been run out of Atlanta by evil sea gods, then he had failed to stop a giant shrimp attack on the Argo II. Then the Ichthyocentaurs, Chiron's brothers, hadn't even wanted to meet him. After all that, they had arrived at the Pillars of Hercules and Percy had to stay aboard ship while Jason, the Big Shot, visited his half-brother. Hercules, the most famous demigod of all time. And Percy didn't get to meet him either. Okay, sure. From what Piper said afterward, Hercules was a jerk. But still, Percy was getting kind of tired of staying aboard ship and pacing the deck. The open sea was supposed to be his territory. Percy was supposed to step up, take charge, and keep everybody safe. Instead, all the way across the Atlantic, he'd done pretty much nothing except make small talk with sharks and listen to Coach Hedge sing TV theme songs. To make matters worse, Annabeth had been distant ever since they had left Charleston. She spent most of her time in her cabin studying the bronze map she'd retrieved from Fort Sumter, or looking up information on Daedalus's laptop. Whenever Percy stopped by to see her, she was so lost in thought that the conversation went something like this. Percy.
Hey, how's it going?
Annabeth.
No thanks.
Percy.
Okay. Have you eaten anything today?
Annabeth. I think Leo is on duty. Ask him.
Percy. So, my hair is on fire.
Annabeth. Okay. In a while. She got like this sometimes. It was one of the challenges of dating an Athena girl. Still, Percy wondered what he had to do to get her attention. He was worried about her after her encounter with the spiders at Fort Sumter, and he didn't know how to help her, especially if she shut him out. After leaving the Pillars of Hercules unscathed except for a few coconuts lodged in the hull's bronze plating, the ship traveled by air for a few hundred miles. Percy hoped the ancient lands wouldn't be as bad as they'd heard. but it was almost like a commercial. You'll notice the difference immediately. Several times an hour, something attacked the ship. A flock of flesh-eating Stymphalian birds swooped out of the night sky and Festus torched them. Storm spirits swirled around the mast and Jason blasted them with lightning. While Coach Hedge was having dinner on the foredeck, a wild Pegasus appeared from nowhere, stampeded over the coach's enchiladas, and flew off again, leaving cheesy hoofprints all across the deck.
"What was that for?" the coach demanded.
The sight of the Pegasus made Percy wish Blackjack were here. He hadn't seen his friend in days. Tempest and Orion also hadn't shown themselves. Maybe they didn't want to venture into the Mediterranean. If so, Percy couldn't blame them. Finally, around midnight, after the 9th or 10th aerial attack, Jason turned to him. "How about you get some sleep? I'll keep blasting stuff out of the sky as long as I can. Then we can go by sea for a while and you can take point." Percy wasn't sure that he'd be able to sleep with the boat rocking through the clouds as it was shaken by angry wind spirits, but Jason's idea made sense. He went below deck and crashed on his bunk. His nightmares, of course, were anything but restful. He dreamed he was in a dark cavern. He could only see a few feet in front of him, but the space must have been vast. Water dripped from somewhere nearby, and the sound echoed off distant walls. The way the air moved made Percy suspect the cave's ceiling was far, far above. He heard heavy footsteps, and the twin giants Ephialtes and Otis shuffled out of the gloom. Percy could distinguish them only by their hair. Ephialtes had the green locks braided with silver and gold coins. Otis had the purple ponytail braided with... were those firecrackers? Otherwise, they were dressed identically, and their outfits definitely belonged in a nightmare. They wore matching white slacks and gold buccaneer shirts with V-necks that showed way too much chest hair. A dozen sheathed daggers lined their rhinestone belts. Their shoes were open-toed sandals, proving that, yes, indeed, they had snakes for feet. The straps wrapped around the serpents' necks. Their heads curled up where the toes should be. The snakes flicked their tongues excitedly and turned their gold eyes in every direction, like dogs looking out the window of a car. Maybe it had been a long time since they'd had shoes with a view. The giants stood in front of Percy, but they paid him no attention. Instead, they gazed up into the darkness.
"We're here," Ephialtes announced.
Despite his booming voice, his words dissipated in the cavern, echoing until they sounded small and insignificant. Far above, something answered.
"Yes, I can see that. Those outfits are hard to miss."
The voice made Percy's stomach drop about 6 inches. It sounded vaguely female, but not at all human. Each word was a garbled hiss in multiple tones, as if a swarm of African killer bees had learned to speak English in unison. It wasn't Gia, Percy was sure of that. But whatever it was, the twin giants became nervous. They shifted on their snakes and bobbed their heads respectfully.
"Of course, your ladyship," Ephialtes said. "We bring news of..."
"Why are you dressed like that?"
asked the thing in the dark. She didn't seem to be coming any closer, which was fine with Percy. Ephialtes shot his brother an irritated look.
"My brother was supposed to wear something different. Unfortunately." "You said I was the knife thrower today," Otis protested. "I said I was the knife thrower. You were supposed to be the magician." "Forgive me, your ladyship. You don't want to hear us arguing. We came as you requested to bring you news. The ship is approaching."
Her ladyship, whatever she was, made a series of violent hisses like a tire being slashed repeatedly. With a shudder, Percy realized she was laughing.
"How long?" she asked.
"They should land in Rome shortly after daybreak, I think," Ephialtes said. "Of course, they'll have to get past the Golden Boy."
He sneered as if the Golden Boy was not his favorite person.
"I hope they arrive safely," her ladyship said. "It would spoil our fun to have them captured too soon. Are your preparations made?"
"Yes, your ladyship."
Otis stepped forward, and the cavern trembled, A crack appeared under Otis's left snake.
Careful, you dolt,
her ladyship snarled.
Do you want to return to Tartarus the hard way?
Otis scrambled back, his face slack with terror. Percy realized that the floor, which looked like solid stone, was more like the glacier he'd walked on in Alaska. In some places solid, in other places, not so much. He was glad he weighed nothing in his dreams.
There is little left holding this place together,
her ladyship cautioned.
Except, of course, my own skill. Centuries of Athena's rage can only be contained so well. And the great Earth Mother churns below us in her sleep. Between those two forces, well, my nest has quite eroded. We must hope this child of Athena proves to be a worthy victim. She may be my last plaything.
Ephialtes gulped. He kept his eyes on the crack in the floor.
Soon it will not matter, your ladyship. Geo will rise and we will all be rewarded. You will no longer have to guard this place or keep your works hidden.
Perhaps, said the voice in the dark. But I will miss the sweetness of my revenge. We have worked well together over the centuries, have we not?
The twins bowed. The coins glittered in Ephialtes' hair, and Percy realized with nauseating certainty that some of them were silver drachma, exactly like the one Annabeth had gotten from her mom. Annabeth had told him that in each generation, a few children of Athena were sent on the quest to recover the missing Parthenon statue. None had ever succeeded.
We have worked well together over the centuries.
The giant Ephialtes had centuries' worth of coins in his braids. Hundreds of trophies. Percy pictured Annabeth standing in this dark place alone. He imagined the giant taking that coin she carried and adding it to his collection. Percy wanted to draw his sword and give the giant a haircut starting at the neck. But he was powerless to act. He could only watch.
Your ladyship,
Ephialtes said nervously.
I would remind you that Geo wishes the girl to be taken alive. You can torment her, drive her insane, whatever you wish, of course. But her blood must be spilt on the ancient stones.
Her ladyship hissed.
Others could be used for that purpose.
Yes, Ephialtes said. But this girl is preferred. And the boy, the son of Poseidon, you can see why those two would be most suited for the task.
Percy wasn't sure what that meant, but he wanted to crack the floor and send these stupid gold-shirted twins down to oblivion. He'd never let Gia spill his blood for any task, and there was no way he'd let anyone hurt Annabeth.
We will see, her ladyship grumbled. Leave me now. Tend to your own preparations. You will have your spectacle, and I will work in darkness.
The dream dissolved, and Percy woke with a start. Jason was knocking at his open doorway. We've sat down in the water, he said, looking utterly exhausted. Your turn. Percy didn't want to, but he woke Annabeth. He figured even Coach Hedge wouldn't mind their talking after curfew if it meant giving her information that might save her life. They stood on deck, alone except for Leo, who was still manning the helm. The guy must have been shattered, but he refused to go to sleep.
I don't want any more Shrimpzilla surprises, he insisted.
They'd all tried to convince Leo that the Scolopendra attack hadn't been entirely his fault, but he wouldn't listen. Percy knew how he felt. Not forgiving himself for mistakes was one of Percy's biggest talents. It was about 4 a.m. The weather was miserable. The fog was so thick, Percy couldn't see Festus at the end of the prow, and warm drizzle hung in the air like a bead curtain. As they sailed into 20-foot swells, the sea heaving underneath them, Percy could hear poor Hazel down in her cabin, also heaving. Despite all that, Percy was grateful to be back on the water. He preferred it to flying through storm clouds, and being attacked by man-eating birds and enchilada-trampling pegasi. He stood with Annabeth at the forward rail while he told her about his dream. Percy wasn't sure how she'd take the news. Her reaction was even more troubling than he anticipated. She didn't seem surprised. She peered into the fog.
Percy, you have to promise me something. Don't tell the others about this dream.
Don't what? Annabeth?
What you saw was about the mark of Athena, she said. It won't help the others to know. It'll only make them worry, and it'll make it harder for me to go off on my own.
Annabeth, you can't be serious. That thing in the dark, the big chamber with the crumbling floor.
I know.
Her face looked unnaturally pale, and Percy suspected it wasn't just the fog. But I have to do this alone. Percy swallowed back his anger. He wasn't sure if he was mad at Annabeth, or his dream, or the entire Greek/Roman world that had endured and shaped human history for 5,000 years, with one goal in mind, to make Percy Jackson's life suck as much as possible.
You know what's in that cavern, he guessed. Does it have to do with spiders?
Yes, she said in a small voice.
Then how can you even...
He made himself stop. Once Annabeth had made up her mind, arguing with her wouldn't do any good. He remembered the night 3.5 years ago that they'd saved Nico and Bianca D'Angelo in Maine. Annabeth had been captured by the Titan Atlas. For a while, Percy wasn't sure if she was alive or dead. He'd traveled across the country to save her from the Titan. It had been the hardest few days of his life, not just the monsters and the fighting, but the worry. How could he intentionally let her go now, knowing she was heading into something even more dangerous? Then it dawned on him. The way he had felt back then for a few days was probably how Annabeth had felt for the 6 months he had been missing with amnesia.
That made him feel guilty,
and a little bit selfish to be standing here arguing with her. She had to go on this quest. The fate of the world might depend on it. A part of him wanted to say, "Forget the world." He didn't want to be without her. Percy stared into the fog. He couldn't see anything around them, but he had perfect bearings at sea. He knew their exact latitude and longitude. He knew the depth of the ocean and which way the currents were flowing. He knew the ship's speed and could sense no rocks, sandbars, or other natural dangers in their path. Still, being blind was unsettling. They hadn't been attacked since they had touched the water, but the sea seemed different. Percy had been in the Atlantic, the Pacific, even the Gulf of Alaska, but this sea felt more ancient and powerful. Percy could sense its layers swirling below him. Every Greek or Roman hero had sailed these waters, from Hercules to Aeneas. Monsters still dwelt in the depths, so deeply wrapped in the mist that they slept most of the time. But Percy could feel them stirring, responding to the celestial bronze hull of a Greek trireme and the presence of demigod blood.
They are back, the monsters seemed to say.
Finally, fresh blood.
We're not far from the Italian coast, Percy said, mostly to break the silence. Maybe 100 nautical miles to the mouth of the Tiber.
Good, Annabeth said. By daybreak, we should...
Stop. Percy's skin felt washed with ice. We have to stop.
Why?
Annabeth asked.
Leo, stop!
He yelled.
Too late. The other boat appeared out of the fog and rammed them head on. In that split second, Percy registered random details. Another trireme, black sails painted with a gorgon's head, hulking warriors, not quite human, crowded at the front of the boat in Greek armor, swords and spears ready, and a bronze ram at water level slamming against the hull of the Argo II. Annabeth and Percy were almost thrown overboard. Festus blew fire, sending 12 very surprised warriors screaming and diving into the sea. But more swarmed aboard the Argo II, grappling lines wrapped around the rails and the mast, digging iron claws into the hull's planks. By the time Percy had recovered his wits, the enemy
was everywhere. He couldn't see well through the fog and the dark, but the invaders seemed to be human-like dolphins. Or dolphin-like humans. Some had gray snouts. Others held their swords in stunted flippers. Some waddled on legs partially fused together, while others had flippers for feet, which reminded Percy of clown shoes. Leo sounded the alarm bell. He made a dash for the nearest ballista, but went down under a pile of chattering dolphin warriors. Annabeth and Percy stood back to back as they'd done many times before, their weapons drawn. Percy tried to summon the waves, hoping he could push the ships apart or even capsize the enemy vessel, but nothing happened. It almost felt like something was pushing against his will, wresting the sea from his control. He raised Riptide, ready to fight, but they were hopelessly outnumbered. Several dozen warriors lowered their spears and made a ring around them, wisely keeping out of striking distance of Percy's sword. The dolphin men opened their snouts and made whistling, popping noises. Percy had never considered just how vicious dolphin teeth looked. He tried to think. Maybe he could break out of the circle and destroy a few invaders, but not without the others skewering him and Annabeth. At least the warriors didn't seem interested in killing them immediately. They kept Percy and Annabeth contained while more of their comrades flooded below decks and secured the hull. Percy could hear them breaking down the cabin doors, scuffling with his friends. Even if the other demigods hadn't been fast asleep, they wouldn't have stood a chance against so many. Leo was dragged across the deck, half-conscious and groaning, and dumped on a pile of ropes. Below, the sounds of fighting tapered off. Either the others had been subdued or Percy refused to think about it. On one side of the ring of spears, the dolphin warriors parted to let someone through. He appeared to be fully human, but from the way the dolphins fell back before him, he was clearly the leader. He was dressed in Greek combat armor, sandals, kilt, and greaves, a breastplate decorated with elaborate sea monster designs. And everything he wore was gold. Even his sword, a Greek blade like Riptide, was gold instead of bronze. The Golden Boy, Percy thought, remembering his dream. They'll have to get past the Golden Boy. What really made Percy nervous was the guy's helmet. His visor was a full face mask fashioned like a gorgon's head, curved tusks, horrible features pinched into a snarl, and golden snake hair curling around the face. Percy had met gorgons before. The likeness was good, a little too good for his taste. Annabeth turned so she was shoulder to shoulder with Percy. He wanted to put his arm around her protectively, but he doubted she'd appreciate the gesture, and he didn't want to give the golden guy any indication that Annabeth was his girlfriend. No sense giving the enemy more leverage than they already had.
"Who are you?" Percy demanded. "What do you want?"
The golden warrior chuckled. With a flick of his blade, faster than Percy could follow, he smacked Riptide out of Percy's hand and sent it flying into the sea. He might as well have thrown Percy's lungs into the sea, because suddenly Percy couldn't breathe. He'd never been disarmed so easily.
"Hello, brother."
The golden warrior's voice was rich and velvety with an exotic accent, Middle Eastern maybe, that seemed vaguely familiar.
"Always happy to rob a fellow son of Poseidon. I am Chrysaor, the Golden Sword. As for what I want..."
He turned his metal mask toward Annabeth.
"Well, that's easy. I want everything you have."
Chapter 30. Percy. Percy's heart did jumping jacks while Chrysaor walked back and forth, inspecting them like prized cattle. A dozen of his dolphin man warriors stayed in a ring around them, spears leveled at Percy's chest, while dozens more ransacked the ship, banging and crashing around below decks. One carried a box of ambrosia up the stairs, another carried an armful of ballista bolts and a crate of Greek fire.
"Careful with that," Annabeth warned. "It'll blow up both our ships."
"Ha," Chrysaor said. "We know all about Greek fire, girl. Don't worry. We've been looting and pillaging ships on the Mare Nostrum for eons."
"Your accent sounds familiar," Percy said. "Have we met?"
"I haven't had the pleasure.
Chrysaor's golden gorgon mask snarled at him, though it was impossible to tell what his real expression might be underneath.
But I've heard all about you, Percy Jackson. Oh, yes, the young man who saved Olympus and his faithful sidekick, Annabeth Chase.
I'm nobody's sidekick, Annabeth growled. And, Percy, his accent sounds familiar because he sounds like his mother. We killed her in New Jersey.
Percy frowned. I'm pretty sure that accent isn't New Jersey. Who's his... Oh.
It all fell into place. Auntie M's Garden Gnome Emporium. The lair of Medusa. She'd talked with that same accent, at least until Percy had cut off her head.
Medusa is your mom? He asked. Dude, that sucks for you.
Judging from the sound in Chrysaor's throat, he was now snarling under the mask, too.
You are as arrogant as the first, Perseus, Chrysaor said. But yes, Percy Jackson, Poseidon was my father. Medusa was my mother. After Medusa was changed into a monster by that so-called goddess of wisdom. The golden mask turned on Annabeth. That would be your mother, I believe. Medusa's two children were trapped inside her, unable to be born. When the original Perseus cut off Medusa's head, two children sprang out, Annabeth remembered. Pegasus and you.
Percy blinked.
So your brother is a winged horse, but you're also my half-brother, which means all the flying horses in the world are my... You know what? Let's forget it.
He'd learned years ago it was better not to dwell too much on who was related to whom on the godly side of things. After Tyson the Cyclops adopted him as a brother, Percy decided that that was about as far as he wanted to extend the family.
But if you're Medusa's kid, he said, why haven't I ever heard of you?
Chrysaor sighed in exasperation.
When your brother is Pegasus, you get used to being forgotten. Oh, look, a winged horse. Does anyone care about me?
No.
He raised the tip of his blade at Percy's eyes.
But don't underestimate me. My name means the golden sword for a reason.
Imperial gold? Percy guessed. Ah, enchanted gold, yes.
Later on, the Romans called it imperial gold, but I was the first to ever wield such a blade. I should have been the most famous hero of all time. Since the legend tellers decided to ignore me, I became a villain instead. I resolved to put my heritage to use. As the son of Medusa, I would inspire terror. As the son of Poseidon, I would rule the seas.
You became a pirate, Annabeth summed up. Chrysaor spread his arms, which was fine with Percy since it got the sword point away from his eyes.
The best pirate, Chrysaor said. I've sailed these waters for centuries, waylaying any demigods foolish enough to explore the Mare Nostrum. This is my territory now, and all you have is mine.
One of the dolphin warriors dragged Coach Hedge up from below.
Let me go, you tuna fish, Hedge bellowed.
He tried to kick the warrior, but his hoof clanged off his captor's armor. Judging from the hoof-shaped prints in the dolphin's breastplate and helmet, the coach had already made several attempts.
Ah, a satyr, Chrysaor mused. A little old and stringy, but Cyclopes will pay well for a morsel like him. Chain him up.
I'm nobody's goat meat, Hedge protested.
Gag him as well, Chrysaor decided.
Why, you gilded little...
Hedge's insult was cut short when the dolphin put a greasy wad of canvas in his mouth. Soon the coach was trussed like a rodeo calf and dumped with the other loot, crates of food, extra weapons, even the magical ice chest from the mess hall.
You can't do this, Annabeth shouted.
Chrysaor's laughter reverberated inside his gold face mask. Percy wondered if he was horribly disfigured under there, or if his gaze could petrify people the way his mother's could.
I can do anything I want, Chrysaor said. My warriors have been trained to perfection. They are vicious, cutthroat.
Dolphins, Percy noted.
Chrysaor shrugged.
Yes. So? They had some bad luck a few millennia ago, kidnapped the wrong person. Some of their crew got turned completely into dolphins. Others went mad. But these survived as hybrid creatures. When I found them under the sea and offered them a new life, they became my loyal crew. They fear nothing.
One of the warriors chattered at him nervously.
Yes, yes, Chrysaor growled. They fear one thing. But it hardly matters. He's not here.
An idea began tickling at the base of Percy's skull. Before he could pursue it, more dolphin warriors climbed the stairs, hauling up the rest of his friends. Jason was unconscious. Judging from the new bruises on his face, he'd tried to fight. Hazel and Piper were bound hand and foot. Piper had a gag in her mouth, so apparently the dolphins had discovered she could charm speak. Frank was the only one missing, though two of the dolphins had bee stings covering their faces. Could Frank actually turn into a swarm of bees? Percy hoped so. If he was free aboard the ship somewhere, that could be an advantage, assuming Percy could figure out how to communicate with him.
Excellent, Chrysaor gloated.
He directed his warriors to dump Jason by the crossbows. Then he examined the girls like they were Christmas presents, which made Percy grit his teeth.
The boy is no use to me, Chrysaor said, but we have an understanding with the witch Circe. She will buy the women, either as slaves or trainees, depending on their skill. But not you, lovely Annabeth.
Annabeth recoiled. You are not taking me anywhere. Percy's hand crept to his pocket. His pen had appeared back in his jeans. He only needed a moment's distraction to draw his sword. Maybe if he could take down Chrysaor quickly, his crew would panic. He wished he knew something about Chrysaor's weakness. Usually Annabeth provided him with information like that, but apparently Chrysaor didn't have any legends. So they were both in the dark. The golden warrior tutted,
Oh, sadly, Annabeth, you will not be staying with me. I would love that, but you and your friend Percy are spoken for. A certain goddess is paying a high bounty for your capture, alive if possible, though she didn't say you had to be unharmed.
At that moment, Piper caused the disturbance they needed. She wailed so loudly it could be heard through her gag. Then she fainted against the nearest guard, knocking him over. Hazel got the idea and crumpled to the deck, kicking her legs and thrashing like she was having a fit. Percy drew Riptide and lashed out. The blade should have gone straight through Chrysaor's neck. But the golden warrior was unbelievably fast. He dodged and parried as the dolphin warriors backed up, guarding the other captives while giving their captain room to battle. They chattered and squeaked, egging him on, and Percy got the sinking suspicion the crew was used to this sort of entertainment. They didn't feel their leader was in any sort of danger. Percy hadn't crossed swords with an opponent like this since... well, since he'd battled the war god Ares. Chrysaor was that good. Many of Percy's powers had gotten stronger over the years, but now, too late, Percy realized that swordplay wasn't one of them. He was rusty. At least against an adversary like Chrysaor. They battled back and forth, thrusting and parrying. Without meaning to, Percy heard the voice of Luke Castellan, his first sword-fighting mentor at Camp Half-Blood, throwing out suggestions, but it didn't help. The golden gorgon mask was too unnerving. The warm fog, the slick deck boards, the chattering of the warriors, none of it helped. And in the corner of his eye, Percy could see one of the dolphin men holding a knife at Annabeth's throat in case she tried anything tricky. He feinted and thrust at Chrysaor's gut, but Chrysaor anticipated the move. He knocked Percy's sword out of his hand again, and once more Riptide flew into the sea. Chrysaor laughed easily. He wasn't even winded. He pressed the tip of his golden sword against Percy's sternum.
A good try, said the pirate. But now you'll be chained and transported to Gia's minions. They are quite eager to spill your blood and wake the goddess.
Chapter 31. Percy. Nothing like total failure to generate great ideas. As Percy stood there, disarmed and outmatched, the plan formed in his head. He was so used to Annabeth providing Greek legend information that he was kind of stunned to actually remember something useful. But he had to act fast. He couldn't let anything happen to his friends. He wasn't going to lose Annabeth. Not again. Chrysaor couldn't be beat. At least not in single combat. But without his crew, maybe then he could be overwhelmed if enough demigods attacked him at once. How to deal with Chrysaor's crew? Percy put the pieces together. The pirates had been turned into dolphin men millennia ago when they had kidnapped the wrong person. Percy knew that story. Heck, the wrong person in question had threatened to turn him into a dolphin. And when Chrysaor said the crew wasn't afraid of anything, one of the dolphins had nervously corrected him. Yes, Chrysaor said, but he's not here. Percy glanced toward the stern and spotted Frank, in human form, peeking out from behind a ballista, waiting. Percy resisted the urge to smile. The big guy claimed to be clumsy and useless, but he always seemed to be in exactly the right place when Percy needed him. The girls, Frank, the ice chest. It was a crazy idea, but as usual, that's all Percy had.
Fine, Percy shouted, so loudly that he got everyone's attention. Take us away if our captain will let you.
Chrysaor turned his golden mask.
What, captain? My men searched the ship. There is no one else.
Percy raised his hands dramatically.
The god appears only when he wishes, but he is our leader. He runs our camp for demigods, doesn't he, Annabeth?
Annabeth was quick. Yes, she nodded enthusiastically.
Mr. D, the great Dionysus.
A ripple of uneasiness passed through the dolphin men. One dropped his sword.
Stand fast, Chrysaor bellowed. There is no god on this ship. They are trying to scare you.
You should be scared.
Percy looked at the pirate crew with sympathy.
Dionysus will be severely cranky with you for having delayed our voyage. He will punish all of us. Didn't you notice the girls falling into the wine god's madness?
Hazel and Piper had stopped the shaking fits. They were sitting on the deck, staring at Percy. But when he glared at them pointedly, they started hamming it up again, trembling and flopping around like fish. The dolphin men fell over themselves, trying to get away from their captives.
Fix! Chrysaor roared. Shut up, Percy Jackson. Your camp director is not here. He was recalled to Olympus. This is common knowledge.
So you admit Dionysus is our director, Percy said.
He was, Chrysaor corrected. Everyone knows that.
Percy gestured at the golden warrior like he'd just betrayed himself.
You see? We are doomed. If you don't believe me, let's check the ice chest.
Percy stormed over to the magical cooler. No one tried to stop him. He knocked open the lid and rummaged through the ice. There had to be one. Please.
He was rewarded with a silver and red can of soda. He brandished it at the dolphin warriors as if spraying them with bug repellent. Behold, Percy shouted, the god's chosen beverage. Tremble before the horror of Diet Coke.
The dolphin men began to panic. They were on the edge of retreat. Percy could feel it.
The god will take your ship, Percy warned. He will finish your transformation into dolphins, or make you insane, or transform you into insane dolphins. Your only hope is to swim away now, quickly.
Ridiculous,
Chrysaor's voice turned shrill. He didn't seem sure where to level his sword, at Percy or his own crew.
Save yourselves, Percy warned. It is too late for us.
Then he gasped and pointed at the spot where Frank was hiding.
Oh no! Frank is turning into a crazy dolphin!
Nothing happened.
I said, Percy repeated, Frank is turning into a crazy dolphin!
Frank stumbled out of nowhere, making a big show of grabbing his throat.
Oh no,
he said, like he was reading from a teleprompter.
I am turning into a crazy dolphin!
He began to change, his nose elongating into a snout, his skin becoming sleek and gray. He fell to the deck as a dolphin, his tail thumping against the boards. The pirate crew disbanded in terror, chattering and clicking as they dropped their weapons, forgot the captives, ignored Chrysaor's orders, and jumped overboard. In the confusion, Annabeth moved quickly to cut the bonds on Hazel, Piper, and Coach Hedge. Within seconds, Chrysaor was alone and surrounded. Percy and his friends had no weapons except for Annabeth's knife and Hedge's hooves, but the murderous looks on their faces evidently convinced the Golden Warrior he was doomed. He backed to the edge of the rail.
"This isn't over, Jackson," Chrysaor growled. "I will have my revenge."
His words were cut short by Frank, who had changed form again. An 800-pound grizzly bear can definitely break up a conversation. He sideswiped Chrysaor and raked the golden mask off his helmet. Chrysaor screamed, instantly covering his face with his arms and tumbling into the water. They ran to the rail. Chrysaor had disappeared. Percy thought about chasing him, but he didn't know these waters, and he didn't want to confront that guy alone again.
"That was brilliant,"
Annabeth kissed him, which made him feel a little better.
"It was desperate," Percy corrected, "and we need to get rid of this pirate trireme."
"Burn it?"
Annabeth asked. Percy looked at the Diet Coke in his hand.
"No, I've got another idea."
It took them longer than Percy wanted. As they worked, he kept glancing at the sea, waiting for Chrysaor and his pirate dolphins to return, but they didn't. Leo got back on his feet, thanks to a little nectar. Piper tended to Jason's wounds, but he wasn't as badly hurt as he looked. Mostly he was just ashamed that he'd gotten overpowered again, which Percy could relate to. They returned all their own supplies to the proper places and tidied up from the invasion while Coach Hedge had a field day on the enemy ship, breaking everything he could find with his baseball bat. When he was done, Percy loaded the enemy's weapons back on the pirate ship. Their storeroom was full of treasure, but Percy insisted that they touch none of it.
"I can sense about $6 million worth of gold aboard," Hazel said, "plus diamonds, rubies."
"$6 million?
Frank stammered.
"Canadian dollars or American?"
"Leave it," Percy said. "It's part of the tribute."
"Tribute?" Hazel asked. "Oh,"
Piper nodded.
"Kansas."
Jason grinned. He'd been there too when they'd met the wine god. "Crazy, but I like it." Finally, Percy went aboard the pirate ship and opened the flood valves. He asked Leo to drill a few extra holes in the bottom of the hull with his power tools, and Leo was happy to oblige. The crew of the Argo II assembled at the rail and cut the grappling lines. Piper brought out her new Horn of Plenty and, on Percy's direction, willed it to spew Diet Coke, which came out with the strength of a fire hose dousing the enemy deck. Percy thought it would take hours, but the ship sank remarkably fast, filling with Diet Coke and seawater.
"Dionysus," Percy called, holding up Chrysaor's golden mask. "Or Bacchus, whatever. You made this victory possible, even if you weren't here. Your enemies tremble at your name. Or your Diet Coke, or something. So yeah, thank you."
The words were hard to get out, but Percy managed not to gag.
"We give this ship to you as tribute. We hope you like it."
"$6 million in gold," Leo muttered. "He'd better like it."
"Shh," Hazel scolded. "Precious metal isn't all that great, believe me."
Percy threw the golden mask aboard the vessel, which was now sinking even faster, brown fizzy liquid spewing out the trireme's ore slots and bubbling from the cargo hold, turning the sea frothy brown. Percy summoned a wave, and the enemy ship was swamped. Leo steered the Argo II away as the pirate vessel disappeared underwater.
"Isn't that polluting?" Piper asked.
"I wouldn't worry," Jason told her. "If Bacchus likes it, the ship should vanish."
Percy didn't know if that would happen, but he felt like he'd done all he could. He had no faith that Dionysus would hear them or care, much less help them in their battle against the twin giants, but he had to try. As the Argo II headed east into the fog, Percy decided at least one good thing had come out of his sword fight with Chrysaor. He was feeling humble, even humble enough to pay tribute to the wine dude. After their bout with the pirates, they decided to fly the rest of the way to Rome. Jason insisted he was well enough to take sentry duty, along with Coach Hedge, who was still so charged with adrenaline that every time the ship hit turbulence, he swung his bat and yelled, "Die!" They had a couple of hours before daybreak, so Jason suggested Percy try to get a few more hours of sleep. "It's fine, man," Jason said. "Give somebody else a chance to save the ship, huh?" Percy agreed, though once in his cabin, he had trouble falling asleep. He stared at the bronze lantern swaying from the ceiling and thought about how easily Chrysaor had beaten him at swordplay. The golden warrior could have killed him without breaking a sweat. He'd only kept Percy alive because someone else wanted to pay for the privilege of killing him later. Percy felt like an arrow had slipped through a chink in his armor, as if he still had the blessing of Achilles, and someone had found his weak spot. The older he got, the longer he survived as a half-blood, the more his friends looked up to him. They depended on him and relied on his powers. Even the Romans had raised him on a shield and made him praetor, and he'd only known them for a couple of weeks. But Percy didn't feel powerful. The more heroic stuff he did, the more he realized how limited he was. He felt like a fraud. "I'm not as great as you think," he wanted to warn his friends. His failures, like tonight, seemed to prove it. Maybe that's why he had started to fear suffocation. It wasn't so much drowning in the earth or the sea, but the feeling that he was sinking into too many expectations, literally getting in over his head. Wow. When he started having thoughts like that, he knew he'd been spending too much time with Annabeth. Athena had once told Percy his fatal flaw. He was supposedly too loyal to his friends. He couldn't see the big picture. He would save a friend even if it meant destroying the world. At the time, Percy had shrugged this off. How could loyalty be a bad thing? Besides, things worked out okay against the Titans. He'd saved his friends and beaten Kronos. Now, though, he started to wonder. He would gladly throw himself at any monster, god, or giant to keep his friends from being hurt. But what if he wasn't up to the task? What if someone else had to do it? That was very hard for him to admit. He even had trouble with simple things like letting Jason take a turn at watch. He didn't want to rely on someone else to protect him, someone who could get hurt on his account. Percy's mom had done that for him. She'd stayed in a bad relationship with a gross mortal guy because she thought it would save Percy from monsters. Grover, his best friend, had protected Percy for almost a year before Percy even realized he was a demigod. And Grover had almost gotten killed by the Minotaur. Percy wasn't a kid anymore. He didn't want anybody he loved taking a risk for him. He had to be strong enough to be the protector himself. But now he was supposed to let Annabeth go off on her own to follow the mark of Athena, knowing she might die. If it came to a choice, save Annabeth or let the quest succeed, could Percy really choose the quest? Exhaustion finally overtook him. He fell asleep, and in his nightmare, the rumble of thunder became the laughter of the earth goddess Gia. Percy dreamed he was standing on the front porch of the big house at Camp Half-Blood. The sleeping face of Gia appeared on the side of Half-Blood Hill, her massive features formed from the shadows on the grassy slopes. Her lips didn't move, but her voice echoed across the valley. "So this is your home," Gia murmured. "Take a last look, Percy Jackson. You should have returned here. At least then you could have died with your comrades when the Romans invade. Now your blood will be spilled far from home, on the ancient stones, and I will rise." The ground shook. At the top of Half-Blood Hill, Thalia's pine tree burst into flames. Disruption rolled across the valley, grass turning to sand, forest crumbling.